Please pray with me. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, beloved Jesus Christ, blessed Master,
dearest Mother,
saints and sages of all religions,
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles. And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only King.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Reading from The Essential Rumi, translation by Coleman Barks, entitled Nasu. Some time ago, there was a man named Nasu. He made his living shampooing women in the bathhouse. He had a face like a woman, but he was not effeminate, though he disguised his virility so as to keep his job. He loved touching the women as he washed their hair. He stayed sexually alert, at full strength, all the time, massaging the beautiful women, especially the princess and her ladies-in-waiting. Sometimes he thought of changing jobs, of doing something where he wouldn't be so constantly lustful, but he couldn't quit. He went to a mystic saint and said, "Please remember me in a prayer." That holy man was spiritually free and totally open to God. He knew Nasu's secret, but with God's gentleness, he didn't speak it. A Gnostic says little, but inside he is full of mysteries and crowded with voices. Whoever is served that cup keeps quiet. The holy man laughed softly and prayed aloud, "May God cause you to change your life in the way you know you should." Prayer was such a sheik is different from other prayers. He has so completely dissolved his ego, nothinged himself, that he says is what like God talking to God. How could such a prayer not be granted? The means were found to change Nasu. While he was pouring water into a basin for a naked woman, she felt and discovered that a pearl was missing from her earring. Quickly they locked the doors. They searched the cushions, the towels, the rugs, and the discarded clothes. Nothing. Now they searched ears and mouths and every cleft and orifice. Everyone is made to strip, and the Queen's Lady Chamberlain probed one by one the naked women. Nasu, meanwhile, had gone to his private closet, trembling. "I didn't steal the pearl. But if they undress and search me, they'll see how excited I get with these nude ladies. God, please help me. I have been cold and lecherous, but cover my sin this time, please. Let me not be exposed for how I have been. I repent." He weeps and moans and weeps, for the moment is upon him. "Nasu, we have searched everyone but you. Come out." At that moment, his spirit grows wings and lifts. His ego falls like a battered wall. He unites with God alive, but emptied of Nasu. His ship sinks, and in place moves the ocean waves. His body's disgrace, like a falcon's loosened binding, slips from the falcon's foot. His stones drink in water. His field shines like satin with gold threads in it. Someone dead 100 years steps out well and strong and handsome. A broken stick breaks into bud. This all happens inside Nashu. After the call that gave him such fear, a long pause, a long waiting silence. Then a shout from one of the women. Here it is! The battlefield fills with clapping. Nashu sees how his life sparkling out before him. The women come to apologize. We're so sorry we didn't trust you. We just knew that you had taken the pearl. They kept talking about how they suspected him and begging his forgiveness. Finally, he replies, I am much more guilty than anyone has thought or said. I am the worst person in the world. What you have said is only 1/100 of what I've actually done. Don't ask my pardon. You don't know me. No one knows me. God has hidden my sneakiness. Satan taught me tricks. But after a time, that became easy, and I taught Satan some new variations. God saw what I did, but chose not to publicly reveal my sin. And now I am sown back into wholeness. Whatever I have done now was not done. Whatever obedience I didn't do, now I did. Pure, noble, free, like a cypress, like a lily, is how I suddenly am. I said, oh no, help me. And that oh no became a rope let down in my well. I climbed out to stand here in the sun. One moment I was at the bottom of a dank, fearful narrowness, and the next I am not contained by this universe. If every tip of every hair on me could speak, I still couldn't say my gratitude. In the middle of these streets and gardens, I stand and say again, and it's all I say. I wish everyone could know what I know. Isn't that wonderful? We are all born into this world as man and woman. And we come into this world to express our soul, which is neither man nor woman. And yet we're given this body, which reflects either from an electromagnetic standpoint a positive or a negative pole, of which we are embedded within throughout our body, throughout our memories of perhaps many lifetimes, sometimes existing as man, perhaps sometimes existing as woman, and intermixed back and forth. There is no such thing as sexuality in the purest God sense, for those poles come together, the positive and the negative, and unite into a one unipole. And at that point, there is no tension, there is no separation, there is no difference. It's an interesting thing when there were some Pharisees or Sadducees, I think they were Sadducees, and there was a certain sect within Judaism at the time of Jesus who, interestingly enough, believed in God but believed not in afterlife. And so they came to ask Jesus a kind of trick question. They said, Master, and of course they weren't sincere when they said the word, but nevertheless they used it. They said, Master, if a man were married to a woman, if a woman were married to a man, and that man should die, and then she should marry his brother, and then he should die, and so on, that went 7 different times, where the brother would die, her husband, and she would marry his brother. When it came to going into heaven, whom would she be married to? That's an interesting question when you think about it. And Jesus' answer was perhaps startling to them, because he said, in heaven, you live as brother and sister, and therefore there is no husband nor wife. No one special. Sri Yukteswar talks about going into the astral realms. And when you enter into your astral body, you meet so many of the people that you have known
through so many different lifetimes. And you have had so many different husbands, so many different wives, so many different mothers, so many different children, that you don't know who to love especially. So you learn to love all alike. This is the expanding of the heart. And yet we live in this world where man and woman exists. And God has ordained it so. Now, Master says originally that man and woman had no sexual organs. It wasn't until the life force was guided down into the lower extremities of the body that the sexual organs came into being, and that's a very interesting idea. Nevertheless, we are born into a world where sexuality exists. It's positive and negative, separate us one from another. And in God's wisdom, He has created this world in this way. And Mother didn't shy away from her own femininity. In truth, she was the most balanced person I ever knew. She had a great masculine force from an archetypical standpoint. Archetypes are not concerned with personalities, but rather more universal notions and energies. And from an archetypical standpoint, male energy is that protective energy. It is the energy that goes out, that creates, that moves towards something. And the feminine energy is receptive energy and receives. And from that standpoint, there is both male and female within us all. In general, women have more feminine energy. This isn't always the case, but usually. And there is a kind of intuition and feeling and receptivity that is predominant within feminine. And within masculine, there is that projective energy, the creative intelligence that goes out. And this is how man and woman come together and complement each other. And so through that complementary energies, new children are created. And when children are brought into this world, it's a wonderful thing. It's a thing that is full of mystery. Because something becomes common, oftentimes, we don't fully acknowledge the mysterious forces that go into what is being observed. But a child is a truly marvelous thing. That the spermatozoa and ovum can come together, creating one cell and then beginning to multiply, and creating so many cells and then cells knowing what to divide into and manifest. As one begins with the medulla and the subtle nervous system, and then goes out and other cells develop into organs, and some for the brain and all through the body. If it develops normally, develops into a full human body, all the cells, each one discreetly knowing exactly what to do. And within each one of the cells, there is a city. There are multiple functions, many, many functions, hundreds of thousands of functions going on within a single cell. It is fantastic, really. And all the architecture for a human being is contained within each and every single cell. It's a fantastic thing when you really look at it and you really see how creation has come about. So we cannot say from any standpoint at all some of the notions that have come down through time that sex is dirty or bad or wrong in any way other than lack of respect for this tremendous creative force that has brought man and woman together. It is fantastic, really. And when you honor it, when you look at it with full respect, when you see how powerful sexual energy is within each and every man and woman, it is reflective of the power that has gone in to create this entire universe. Because it was embedded within each one of us, just as it's embedded within each cell, within the body, embedded within the soul is the same creative power and intelligence that has brought this entire universe into being. And that is contained within the soul itself. And so we find there a tremendous mystery, a tremendous beauty, a tremendous wonder. But when that sexual energy is treated cheaply, without regard, without respect for its power, for its beauty, for its transformative force, then we really cheapen life. And we see that so much around us today. Sex is used to sell things, of all things. To sell things, to attract people in the wrong way to each other. To fulfill sexual impulse just for the sake of fulfilling it. None of that is showing any proper respect or gratitude or understanding of what this sexual force has really come to do. Because also embedded within this sexual force is the power to transform the human soul from the human into the divine. And this is the greatest mystery of all. And so we see the pattern as God has projected it out, that man and woman come together, produce a family, and within that family, there is the safety, there is the security, there is the support that engenders the best opportunity for the child to develop and to grow, to get the example of both the mother and the father, the feminine and the masculine, so that that one may embody the best of both attributes. As I said, mother was the most balanced individual I've ever known in this sense. Because she had that tremendous masculine force, but she was totally feminine. And she loved being a woman. There was a kind of idea that was put forth some years ago that men and women were really identical, only they are socialized differently. Now, anyone who's had male and female children know what a fallacy this kind of thing is. We're fundamentally wired differently. And mother used to say, "Viva la difference." She liked it. She enjoyed it. But she also saw how it could be degraded. But she enjoyed the beauty and the original innocence and the simplicity. It's wonderful to see the differences that men and women bring together. It's oftentimes said that women are the civilizing force for men. If they weren't around, then men wouldn't know how to do anything to take care of themselves or to do anything of a higher kind of social order. And perhaps this is true. Women bring something very specific to this world. And they should tap into that and revel in that and bring it out with all of the love and all the power of feeling within them. And men, too, should find out what is unique in their role within this world. Mother oftentimes, as us young male devotees, would ask us to open the car door for her, to open the door. We were coming up in a time when those things were being put aside, but she liked the idea of a man being a gentleman and treating a woman like a lady. And these are wonderful things. They're not things that put people down. But rather they lift us up. They make us mindful and thoughtful of each other. I would hear Swamiji counseling various people about family problems. And sometimes there was not proper respect shown within a family, and somebody would get upset by this. And his advice usually ran toward serving those in the family. If you have a feeling of service within the family, and you serve your wife, you serve your husband, you serve your children, you serve your parents, and you do it with a selfless attitude, you find freedom and you find joy in this. Now, this kind of service should run both ways. There should be respect. There should be love. We shouldn't treat relationships too casually, because through that casual inference, we are not treating God within the other person properly, because God certainly exists within them. And so we learn to treat each other with that kind of loving respect. And when we do, we have a harmonious family. We have a harmonious relationship. We feel that we are centered right directly in ourselves. Most people get tripped up because they get hurt or offended or angered by something that somebody else does. And because they have not fully defined themselves within their true self, they feel like they have to defend themselves or change the other person through anger, through a cold kind of indifference, and create walls one from another. This is not a well thought out idea or strategy, and it has long-term consequences. And we see many relationships where people withhold themselves from each other, and they can live in a kind of cold indifference. And it's a terrible thing. And it can come in very subtly, and it's very easy to fall into. You start to withhold yourself from the other person. They didn't do what I wanted them to do. They disappointed me. So I'm not going to do something good for them or nice for them or something that I know they would like. The other person, of course, notices, and they begin to withhold from the other. And pretty soon, nobody's giving to anybody. Now, the principle, as Jesus said it, is as you give, so shall you receive. But we like to think, as I receive, well, maybe I'll think about giving a little bit. Only as we give shall we receive. Do we give kindness? Do we give respect? Do we give service to one another? When our hearts are filled with that, then we find an inner freedom that transcends any relationship. We rise above the situation, and we feel the effects of that freedom, of that joy, of that love. Now, this doesn't make us a doormat. Sometimes people don't behave properly. Sometimes it becomes such a negative situation that it must be ended because it's just not right. And one person will die as a soul. They will die to their soul if they are left in that kind of toxic situation. But when you have two people who are willing to try, and two people who are willing to give, however imperfectly, then you continue to work on that until it becomes perfect. We are all imperfect from that standpoint, from a human standpoint. But we can seek to manifest the perfect within us. You don't have to create the perfect. It is already within you. That is great news. And it takes away so much of our feeling of hopelessness that we can ever achieve anything higher. That perfect, true soul, who you were created by in God from the very beginning, is with you even now. And this is a wonderful thing. Now, from the Bhagavad Gita, we have chapter 15 and verse 1. And the Blessed Lord said, "The wise speak of the eternal Ashvata tree, with roots above and boughs beneath, whose leaves are Vedic hymns. He who understands this tree of life is a Veda knower." Now, this is very interesting because I don't think any of us in likelihood have seen a tree growing in nature that has the roots above and the boughs beneath. And yet this is what is being said here. This tree that's being referred to here is the tree of the human body. And the roots that are talked about here are the nerves and the whole system of the brain. And because the roots are pointed upward, they draw their light, they draw their strength, they draw their life from the divine source. And then it goes down the trunk of the spine and out through all the efferent and afferent nerves that make up the branches and the leaves of this tree. Now, the knower of the Vedas is the knower of realization. And this tree is meant to manifest divine vibration. That is what the Vedas represent here. It's the divine vibration, the intelligence of God permeating throughout the tree and manifesting out through the tree. And so this is a wonderful description of what happens right within our own body. Now, in the story of Adam and Eve, it is said that there was the tree of knowledge of good and evil that was in the midst of the garden, and God said, "Do not touch of the fruit of this tree." Now, the knowledge of good and evil is duality. And before that, man existed in a universal consciousness. The midst of the body is represented by the sexual organs. And that if man or woman concentrated upon those sexual organs, it would awaken the sexual force manifesting out through the body. Before that, it is said that man and woman could reproduce without sexual contact. Mother said that Swami Ashokananda told her that in ancient times, a man could put his hand upon a woman's breast and concentrate there and manifest that soul that would begin to grow within the womb. There were some other methods as well in order to produce, without sexual contact, a new baby. It's quite a thing when you think about it. And if you were to consciously draw into your orbit a soul who was highly developed and who had the attributes that matched your own, then you draw in the perfect soul meant for you and your family. Now, we can replicate that to some extent through prayer. And we can, before we bring a child in, pray to God that we manifest a child that is perfect for our family, and that it will manifest spiritual virtues and seek to have a life in God. Krishna said that it is very rare to be born into a family of yogis. And so for a soul, it is rare and difficult to come by a birth on earth, believe it or not. After 6 billion of us or more, it's still difficult. So you can only imagine the kind of causal events that need to come into play in order for a child to find that perfect family to be born into. And for a more highly developed soul, how much more rare it is to find spiritually developed parents to come into. So this is a wonderful thing, to be able to manifest a divine child. And so you can pray for that. And pray for that child to come in, a child who will help this world, a child who will be a part of the family and will manifest the positive virtues. Now, we know from the lives of the saints that not all the saints, in fact, very few of them, started out with virtuous lives. Sometimes they were rowdy. Sometimes they partied a lot, and they went through a lot of difficulties. But the more they went away from God, the more miserable they became, until they finally would be in such an imprisoned state of mind that they just had to burst to get out of it. And so sometimes that is the route that a child takes, and it doesn't always appear that they're going to take a saintly route. And yet, for a highly developed soul, the further they go away from God, the more miserable they become. And this is the grace of God that operates within us. Now, Master continues with a commentary on that Gita verse. The tree of life has three kinds of leaves or receptors through which the indwelling soul receives knowledge, or the Vedic hymns, of triune phenomenal creation: sensations, life force, and thought perceptions. The metaphor of leaves compared to the Vedic hymns calls forth an image of sensitivity and vitality, the vibrant green leaves denoting life, and whispering motion. Hymns of knowledge, the rustle of leaves. The leaves of the physical tree of life, for example, are the sensory organs in the epidermis and their corresponding centers in the brain, sensitive and full of life, receiving sensations and reporting that knowledge. The waving of these sensory leaves suggests the motion of sensation caused in the nerve centers through which we receive knowledge about the body and the world. Through the help of the sensory commotion, we see colors and forms, hear sounds, taste food, and so forth. When one perceives the proper integration of physical sensory stimuli with the inner tree of life force and consciousness in the astral and causal bodies, true knowledge of the phenomenal world is produced. A man of self-realization, tuning in with the infinite, can see this mysterious tree of nerves, life force, and thought issuing out of cosmic consciousness. He thus becomes omniscient, a knower of the Vedas, and that is, of all knowledge. The ordinary man is absorbed in sensations, which reach him through the sensitive leaves of the spinal tree. He partakes of the fruits of touch, sight, hearing, smell, and taste that exist among the leaves, the sensitive receivers of sensations at the end of the numerous nerve branches. And so we read here how we can attune ourselves to the higher vibration, but in order to do this, we must be able to withdraw the life force from these leaves, from the afferent and efferent nerves. We must be able to withdraw it within the into the spine and then up into the higher centers, at the ajna, the point between the eyebrows, and at the top of the head. And it is here that divine knowledge really becomes manifest. We see that there is a single life principle that pervades throughout all the universe. This is the first born and only begotten Son of God. It is a tremendous force of intelligence and love and compassion that we can ever know. It is the Christ consciousness within you and everywhere all about you. When you are able, through deep meditation and through rising up of the Kundalini energy, which is the transformed sexual force, then these sensitive areas begin to open within the body. It is no longer then a means of conjecture as to what should happen or what the truth is, but rather you are experiencing it directly. When you lift this force up, it withdraws it from the sexual nerves. You feel that there is a tremendous engine that is pumping upwards, that is relieving any stress upon the sexual nerves. This is transmutation. And it is very, very different than repression. Repression of sexual energy is just simply trying to deny it, trying to put it away when it is a driving force within you. But when you transmute it, all of that energy that before had gone out through the sexual nerves is now pumped up. There is as if a trap door within the base of the spine that springs open, and that energy begins to stream up through the spine and into the higher centers. This is a tremendous thing when it happens, and it takes us into the next evolutionary stage. It takes us beyond the human and into the divine. Now, this is a scientific fact. It is something that can be experienced by all true and sincere devotees. Now, the fact that we may not be able to measure it through instrumentation or being able to take pictures of it through x-rays or other kinds of things, does not deny it as a fact. It is just simply that it may not lend itself towards objectifying types of scientific experimentation that can make it verifiable to the outer senses, because this is a very subtle place. Perhaps there are ways of measuring it through instrumentation. But whether it is or it isn't, this force streams up, and it is a powerful force. It will perhaps surprise you at how strong it feels. It matches every criteria that we have for the world of the senses. Only this is an interior state. When we say subtle, we don't necessarily mean ephemeral or that it is like the will-o'-the-wisp. It is a powerful thing, and sometimes people have this initial experience and they begin to shy away from it because they feel how powerful it is. But when it comes, it draws all of that energy up, and you are riveted at the third eye point or at the top of the head. All of that energy is pouring out. And now these doors begin to open of themselves. And you begin to see lights. You begin to hear sounds that are not of this world. They are of these subtle energies. And these are transformative experiences. They begin to refine the nerves and strengthen the nerves that are within the subtle body that allow you to go into God realization. Sri Yukteswar said that if you were to suddenly get this tremendous force without proper preparation, it would burn you out. One time I was sent a mixer when I was in India, and it was made for 110 force that we have here in our electricity. In India, there is a 220 volt. And one day, without thinking properly about it, I plugged it directly into the 220, and it burnt that mixer out in a second. It was gone, and it wouldn't work anymore. And this is what would happen to our nervous system if we were suddenly exposed to this tremendously powerful force. Now, we don't have to worry about it because, in that sense, we have a circuit breaker within us. There's something that doesn't allow that experience to come until we are properly prepared for it. Now, that preparation can take a shorter amount of time or a longer amount of time, depending on where we start the journey at, and also how sincere, how diligent, and how consistent we are in our practice. But when we're properly prepared, then that force comes. And I can tell you, when it came to me, there is no doubt about it. It wasn't what I sometimes hear people say, oh, I was focused on the spine and I felt a little tingling force here and there. That's just simply life energy. That's not the Kundalini. We shouldn't confuse the two. The Kundalini comes, and you have no doubt that you have touched into a volcanic course of transformation. And at that time, without any fear, going forward, you open yourself wider and wider. You have complete trust in God, that whatever comes to you is perfect. Perfect for you, perfect for this world. That God will take care of you. Mother asked Papa what would happen to somebody here in the West if they had these powerful experiences that she was having at the time of this Kundalini. And Papa assured her that God would ever take care of such a one. And so we go forward with perfect faith, with perfect understanding, that whatever happens will be just right for us. We open ourselves to that force. We allow it to have its way with us. We feel that tremendous engine at the base of the spine pumping life force up from this coiled up Kundalini force at the base of the spine. We feel these openings coming in the heart center, in the ajna, in the sahasrara at the top of the head. And we feel this transformation going on all the while. We live a life We live a life in the outer sense that, to all appearances, could be ordinary. We take care of our family. We go to work. We do all the things that we have always done. Now that it is a tremendous challenge, of that there is no doubt. But I can tell you from my own experience that I worked for many, many years a worldly job, and I was able to manage it. Not always perfectly, but I was able to manage it. And it is a tremendous thing to do, but it teaches you balance so that you can operate in this world with your feet on the earth and your head up in the heavens. And when this opens up for you, it is the channel of all bliss, all wisdom, all knowledge. It puts you in touch with the very source of creation, and it is wonderful, and it is beautiful, and it is the greatest contribution that you can make to this world. So do not fear. Do not fear. Put those fears aside and just simply open yourself to what God has for you, because what God has for you is perfect. Jesus said, "Be ye perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect." Now, how in the world could this ever be possible if we're just simply a human being trying to do our best to be good? It's not possible. Only if you have the perfection of God already existing within you could you ever hope to manifest that sort of perfection. And this is what Jesus meant. Now, with this transformed force, it opens up a communion with God, that you may always know God within your soul. There's a wonderful story of Radha and Yashoda. Yashoda was the stepmother of Krishna. And Krishna had left Vrindavan, where he had been raised, and was now living in a distant city. And Yashoda, his stepmother, was missing him terribly. And so she went to see Radha, because Radha, she knew, above all others, perhaps even herself, loved Krishna more than anybody else in this world. And so she went to him, but when she found her, she found that Radha was in a state of bhav. Bhav is an inward state, an absorbed state in God. And so she asked her some questions, but Radha didn't respond because she was so absorbed in this inner state, her communion with her beloved, with Krishna. Finally, her consciousness came back into this world, and she saw that Yashoda was there, a person of high respect for her, and so she pranamed deeply to her. And then Yashoda said, "I'm missing Krishna so much." She said, "Have you heard anything about him?" And Radha said, "I commune with my Krishna all the time. I was just communing with him now. And you have the same capacity." And so she touched her, and through that touch, she was uplifted into that state where she could commune with Krishna. And she felt him. And she knew him, and he knew her, because he existed in universal consciousness. Radha represents the soul in that divine absorption. You will see pictures of Radha and Krishna as they embrace each other, as they dance with each other. And it is the soul and spirit that are in divine communion. And Radha represents that. You'll see it represented oftentimes in more sensual kinds of terms. But all this indicates is that when you are absorbed in God, it will satisfy you every bit as much and more, vastly more, than any kind of sensory preoccupation or touch or experience. That the absorption in God will fill you and make you know that you are ever one with your eternal beloved. And this is the greatest experience that a human being can have. And that is what Radha represents. And so within our souls, if we seek to have that experience of Radha, seek to have that divine absorption into spirit, where any time that we focus our mind, we close our eyes, we feel God so greatly within. And finally, through repeated times of divine absorption, we become so consumed and so identified with that divine spirit that there is never a time when we lose it or leave it. But it is always ours, always ours. And this is the great consummation with our infinite beloved. And then we will know that there is no other, not really, and that all forms are but manifestations of the one infinite beloved. So let us seek to know that experience. Let us go forward unafraid. Let us become absorbed, even as a lover becomes absorbed with their beloved. And let God consume you and take you on this tremendous journey that will take you into your oneness with Him. Please pray with me. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of Thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for Thee. I kneel in adoration at Thy feet and surrender myself to Thee. I feel the power of Thy perfection surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence are radiant with Thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with Thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am He.